You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. I'm going to tell you, for those who haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
I am Natalia Mandina. I'm a pharmacy attorney. And for the last 10 years, I've been working almost exclusively with pharmacies, representing them in regulatory compliance, disciplinary matters, PBM audits, litigation. It's very challenging, very interesting. Pharmacists are very, very pleasant to work with as well.
I guess you could argue that pharmacists have this too, that nobody stops by the pharmacy just to say, hey, I'm doing great. Just wanted to stop by and say thanks for all your help and so on. I mean, in your position, your first phone call with these pharmacists, you must pick up and say hello, and they must go on like a 10-minute bitch session about their problems. Does that get depressing? I mean, you say pharmacists are pleasant, and I know that's what you get paid for, but that's got to be a pain in the ass to hear those kind of complaints every day, no?
I am absolutely honest saying that I love working with pharmacists because I come across physicians very often as well, nurse practitioners. And believe me, working with physicians versus pharmacists is very different. And I don't know why. And of course, I don't want to stereotype anybody, but pharmacists are usually much more respectful, much more pleasant to work with. And they listen. They really listen and they respect what you do. And hardly ever I pick up the phone and they just start, you know, throwing out everything, what's going on with pharmacy.
Why would physicians be worse?
I don't know. I think maybe it also reflects that pharmacists work with patients more. I mean, they're like customer service very often. They have to be pleasant. They have to be respectful. They listen usually more. So I'll give you an example. I had a neurosurgeon as a client once. And the guy with tons of education, you know, millions of dollars a year he makes. And every time I give him advice and say, you know, we need to do this, it was an administrative action, actually. He will say, no, I know better. We got to do it this way. I do not think this is the right approach. And I will be like, well, you're paying me money for giving your professional legal advice, but you know everything. So I hardly ever meet a pharmacist who's telling me what to do.
A community pharmacist would be maybe trying to please more people throughout the day than the average surgeon. I mean, the person's asleep when they're seeing the surgeon, so they probably just don't. It's kind of like their way goes, right?
Yeah. I think they're more social pharmacists versus somebody who's working, has 5 minutes per patient, not listen to the patient, looking at the chart, prescribing, go, you know. And they didn't really interact with patients versus pharmacists who has this hands-on approach to customer care.
I'm in a little bit of a fight with a wholesaler, so I've got this attorney that I'm working with. And sometimes I don't like getting a call from him because I feel bad if I don't take his advice. I know I'm paying for the advice and a lot, and I kind of feel like I should, but it's just advice. It's not gospel truth all the time. So that's got to be kind of strange. I suppose you should get maybe a little fight back from your clients, but you don't want a lot. At some point, you would just say, just go do your own damn thing if you're not going to take any of my advice.
Well, it depends what kind of advice they're seeking. So if we have, for example, a federal investigation, I probably know better which route to go. But if they ask me about potential buyer of their pharmacy, they're probably in a better position to understand their business and to take this offer, not to take this offer. And I, of course, cannot advise them really in business terms, but from legal perspective, I can tell them, you know, this transaction will be very expensive, or, you know, we're going to come across these hurdles during this transaction. Versus if we deal with government, they should listen what I say or any other attorney. Because we deal with government on a daily basis. And I know what they want. I know their strategies. I know their procedure. And it's not going to be very wise if my client will just ignore my advice.
It kind of makes me nervous thinking about dealing with the government. But I guess a lot of people deal with the government when it comes to parking tickets or speeding tickets, or not that I deal with them. That's my wife. But no,
just, lucky you.
But I suppose we're always dealing with the government. But when it comes to dealing with the government, as far as like the DEA and those kind of things, they've got all this power. And you said pharmacists are pleasant when they come to you, but I imagine I'd get kind of freaked out when I have to deal with the government at those kind of levels.
Yeah, they do freak out. They are nervous. And it's understandable. A typical DA audit involves several DA agents. They're not very nice. They come armed, usually. They are very skeptical. They interrogate people.
Armed with guns, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, usually they come armed. That's at least what I hear from my clients. And I think they come armed when there is a reasonable suspicion of that something is going on in the pharmacy. That's a lot of stress, especially if they do have a reasonable suspicion that fraudulent or illegal activity is taking place. Very often they come with FBI as well. And these people are even more unpleasant to work with.
And they've got their dark blue windbreakers on with their big yellow lettering and stuff like that on there. That's got to be intimidating.
It's very intimidating.
On purpose, they make it that intimidating, yeah. Right? Because they want to let you know who's boss right up front.
Well, we can understand, you know, sometimes they have to deal with a lot of crap too. But very often they do routine audits. And given all this attitude, unnecessary, in my opinion, unnecessary. And they scare everybody, especially technicians, so people who are just doing their work, who are not owners of the pharmacy. They close them somewhere separate. They interview them separately. They take their phones. They go through their personal belongings. And they're crying sometimes. And they call me saying, what am I supposed to be doing? I'm like, just wait. Don't talk. You don't have to talk. And the law, they are supposed to review certain records. Yes, but they're not entitled to interview anybody. So you don't really have to talk. So it could be very, very stressful. And what I've seen that very often when they're pressured like that, pharmacy staff makes all kinds of admissions. And that's when it becomes very dangerous.
Well, and I imagine that most people that are calling you don't have your information. I mean, if they're repeat customers, but most of them that are calling you freaked out the first time, it's not like the agents come in and 30 seconds later they're on the phone with you. They've already sat down for 24 hours and have been slapped silly by the DEA and the feds. A lot of people, when they get nervous, they just start blabbing.
Talking.
They start talking.
And guess who's paying attention and noting everything down?
They are.
Yep.
Listeners today to this show who hopefully never think they're going to have to talk to you. That's probably pretty darn good advice, right? Just to shut their yap.
Just don't talk, yes. Especially if they come in with a warrant, so it's not a routine audit. And especially if it's an arrest warrant, and I had cases like that, when they come off the bat with arrest warrant, people try to explain. And a lot of pharmacists, they're naive. They say, because they're so focused on patient care, and they very often not involved in the business aspect. And they will be say, well, I have nothing to hide. These are all my records. This is what I do. There's nothing wrong. Why should I call an attorney? Why should I even discuss this issue? And you're right. Usually I come in not during this first 20 seconds of interaction. I come when we have the whole pile of mess, maybe like a few days later, when my client has some sort of a subpoena to come for an interview with the Department of Justice, something like that. So very often I come much, much later. And that could be, of course, it's more difficult to deal with the case at that stage when they already got all the evidence, lined up all the prosecution, and it's more difficult to dismiss the whole thing.
I've heard, you know, don't talk to people till your attorney's present and so on. It seems like some of those things that a pharmacist would say, like, I'm innocent, I haven't done anything wrong, those kind of things, can those get someone in trouble? Just like the opening comments like that? Part of me wants to say no, because almost everybody's going to say stuff like that. Is there damage even opening up your mouth that much?
No. So what I suggest, always evaluate the situation. If they come in with an arrest warrant, do not open your mouth. Because they're giving you Miranda warning and saying you have a right to call your counsel, la, la, la. So call your counsel. Take advantage of that, because this is arrest.
And an arrest means they're taking you.
Yes. Yes. Well, the first my interview, for the first my get, the I had that, for example, a recent FBI audit that they came with two warrants, search warrant and arrest warrant. So that was a little bit tricky. And the client actually didn't have an idea that it was an arrest warrant. Maybe they sent it, maybe they didn't, but client didn't understand that. So always evaluate the situation. So if this is, let's say, DA is coming to your pharmacy and this is a routine audit, for example, of course you don't want to tell about, you know, well, some people do that, and I can't really say if it's wise or not. They say, you know, I need to call my attorney and talk to them if you can. Well, the DA has the power to audit premises. And again, it could be a good tactic, depending on what's going on in the pharmacy, to tell them, no, I'm not going to allow you to come in. My attorney will be here. Maybe that could be just a, but if it's a regular pharmacy, everything is fine. They have a good compliance program and there's DA coming with an audit. It's always good to establish, there's a local DA guys. Most likely they are renewing your registration. You would deal with them if they have questions, things like that. So you want to establish relationship with them. You want to show them what they're entitled to. You don't want to talk too much still. You don't want to explain every single thing and answer questions which are not asked. But it depends. If they start digging, for example, I'll give you an example of my recent case I have. I actually have it right now. The DA came to this pharmacy, top-notch compliance, everything is good. And they came based on an investigation of a prescriber. It was a doctor who was implicated in this illegal prescription writing. And some of the patients filled the prescription at this pharmacy. And for some reason, the pharmacist did not flag those patients. So when the DA came and they said, you know, this doctor is arrested right now. So I knew a fill in his scripts. So the pharmacy, staff actually was so scared that they started making all kind of admissions saying, well, we thought there was something wrong. We thought there was something fishy. There was this suspicion, but we'll do a better job next time. We'll do much better in the future. The DA doesn't care if you're going to do a better job in the future. They got this admission. And then the pharmacy got maybe a few weeks later a letter from the Department of Justice saying, okay, based on this admission, you violate corresponding responsibility, and if they violate corresponding responsibility, a fine, monetary penalty is $64,000 per occurrence, and there were, I think, 12 prescriptions, so something like that. So it was almost close to $1 million. And I got involved, and we started talking to the AUSA, that's federal attorney. And I'm like, look, they ran PDMP reports. They did absolutely everything. This patient's been the patients of the pharmacy for many, many years. We don't know what's happening with the doctor, but there's a legitimate script. And this attorney, he is armed with admission. He's like, your staff said, we saw there was something wrong with them, but we just didn't call prescriber to verify. Mm. And I'm like, why did you guys say? But they're like, well, we just wanted to cooperate. So...
Right.
That's how dangerous it could be, talking too much. If the DA says, oh, you know, those prescriptions are illegitimate, just don't say anything. Don't argue with them. Like you will have your chance to argue later. You are entitled to show evidence to them saying, no, this is, you know, patient profile. This is a BDNP reports we ran. This is our calls. This is our notes. But don't argue with them saying, oh, you are so right. You know, yeah, I shouldn't have filled it. That's just not a good approach.
People just do that as a way to...
Yeah, compromise. They're trying to compromise.
Compromise. You know, like in a conversation, like a... You know, customers come in and they say, I'm so upset. And my wife hates when I do this mirroring on her. But, you know, with a customer, you're like, well, I understand you're upset, you know, and I can see why you'd be upset and things like that. But when the DEA comes in, don't mirror them. When they say, we think there's a problem here, don't say, yeah, I can understand why you think there's a problem. Don't do that with them.
Yeah, I agree. And some DA agents, they could be even nice. I'm saying it's with quotes, but some of them do want to work with you. I've had very nasty audit, and I had very educational audit. When they pointed out what could have been done better, and that was the end of it. I did have audits like that. So again, I don't want to scare the hell out of everybody saying, well, if the DA comes in, then we have to pull attorney, we have to hide everything. No, it depends again. Especially you might know the DA agents from prior interactions or you know the style, but you have to be careful always about what you say.
As far as their demeanor when they come in, it's surprising. I don't think a lot of professions spend a lot of time on stuff like, for example, I don't know how much time is spent with the police force on how to inform someone that someone has died. I don't know if enough time is spent with surgeons, how to talk about bad news. Maybe they do, and maybe it's better now, but it seems almost cliche that in the past, you would hear that they don't have any training on that. They just have never had it. But I'm wondering with these audits, I'm wondering if these companies tell them what their demeanor should be, you know, because some come in so nasty on even like PBM audits and some come in very friendly. And I wonder if they give them that choice or even tell them how to do that, or if it's all just the personality of the auditor.
So when we talk about PBM audits, I don't know exactly how they train the auditors. I really don't think they talk about demeanor and whether to be nice or mean. The purpose is just to collect as much information as possible. It's usually done even remotely, usually. So, but when we talk about DEA agents, I have a very good friend. He's a special agent in charge in one of the divisions. And I talked to him about him, like, why you guys are so mean? They just play mean. Are they like mean like that in their everyday life? I mean, too bad for their families. It's like, are they like this at home?
Yeah.
He says, no. So usually, there is this power training, especially, and they're trained to deal with bad guys, real bad guys.
Right.
So when they come to, and quote, good pharmacies, I don't think there's such a good or bad pharmacies, but people who are not in trouble, they still use the same tactic because that's how they train. This is what we're supposed to be doing, but they actually train to deal with illegal activities, not with record keeping issues. And they just don't know how to deal with record keeping issues.
They don't separate in their head.
Yeah. Yeah. And very often they use discretion I had so many cases when the pharmacist surrendered the permit voluntarily on the premises. And when I look at the case, I'm like, she just had record keeping issues. Come on. We could have dismissed the whole case, maybe paid something. Not significant. And they surrendered their registration because the DA says, you know, you did so many illegal activities. And if you don't cooperate, we'll cite you with subversion of investigation, things like that, for incorporation. And they're scared. They're like, I don't need this anymore. I don't need anything. I don't sign anything just to make you go away.
Yeah, a lot of people probably have come from different, even like childhood backgrounds of maybe an abusive parent or something like that, or an overbearing parent or something, where they'll bow down to any authority just to get them to stop that pressure. Even if they look 10 minutes later after they left and they said, I just gave away my pharmacy license or something like that.
Yeah, they're just scared. They're really scared. I think it's this even physical fear. Think about this. You are, you know, you're in the middle of your work. You're doing your daily activities and somebody comes, not just somebody. I had a few years ago, it was so funny. My client called me and he has this tiniest pharmacy, tiniest. And there were 10 agents on the premise. I mean, they couldn't even stand there comfortably. And imagine this 10 big guys with guns in uniform come in and say, we have a tip that there's something illegal going on here. Shut down your business right now for the day, at least. He closes the door. He sits down. He thinks, okay, that's it. They're going to take me to prison or something. I mean, this is just it's a physical fear, sure. You know, psychologists that tell us, you know, if we are confronted with a group and we're by ourselves, that's why we have this public speaking fear, because we're confronting the whole group and we're afraid. It's in our genes to be afraid of the group, which is on the other side.
I just told my wife yesterday, we were driving home from being up north, and I said, you know, Margaret, almost all of the pain that I have felt in life has been mental pain, has been being too nervous about things and then trying to look at every direction something could go and then getting all tensed up from that and not liking that feeling and so on. Almost all of my pain has been from being nervous. And she said, oh, I'm sorry about that. And it's like, no, actually, it's a good thing, because I can kind of put all of that into a ball and say, there's all my pain in life has been just in my head. But the point I'm making is, with all those DEA agents there with guns and all the things people have seen about, let's even leave out any brutality. Let's just say getting handcuffs put on and maybe pushed this way and pushed in the car and things like that. That's like a physical thing. Not many people get physically scared, but to your point, that's a physical thing to be afraid of with all of that power in there.
Yep. It's very stressful. I had the client, she's a very good friend of mine. We've been with her for, I don't know, since day one of my practice. And somebody, I think we think it's a competitor, called actually FBI and complained that she actually faking wholesale invoices, and they presented some sort of tape conversation as evidence, as we learned later. So they came to her house in the morning to arrest her. She was feeding her child, who's like 7 years old. They budged in, they handcuffed her, you know, the child is screaming. She doesn't even know what this is all about. And they arrested her. We got her out the same day, but imagine how stressful that is. And she is a pharmacist. She is not some drug dealer or anything like that. That just makes me so mad, so unnecessary. And this is all our money. You know, we're spending money for this unnecessary case. And I understand the agents. You know, sometimes it's difficult to understand who is really doing something criminal and who is actually maybe there's an oversight or record keeping issue. Maybe there is nothing. So very often they don't do enough due diligence to understand, is this really a pill mill? Is this really something fraudulent going on? So they don't do this homework very, very often.
So you're sitting there at work one day, God forbid, you're sitting there and like six people bust through your door, you know, and they've got, like I say, their blue wind jackets on and they've got the initials, either the DEA or the FBI. Is there a chance in a pharmacy you're going to see both of those? And what's the difference as far as what each of those different groups would be there for?
Yes, you can have both of them. So it's not very usual. So what usually happens is the DEA comes with a board of pharmacy. So they don't usually come with the FBI unless there is some indictment or there's something serious going on that they already have enough evidence to involve FBI. Yeah, so the DEA is different from FBI. FBI will be dealing with any fraud. And DEA will be dealing with controlled substance.
Fraud in the terms of like financial fraud usually?
No. Okay, it could be, but I don't do financial fraud, so I can't talk about this. But usually, let me give you an example. So some PBMs are notorious for referring cases to OIGs, to the federal department, they say, we think there's a criminal activity going on. For example, I had a Caremark audit, and an issue was waiver of copays. So the pharmacy was waiving copays for Medicare patients. And actually, we had good defense as well. But still, they flagged this issue. They referred the case to federal government, and FBI came in. So this is healthcare fraud. So that could justify FBI coming in. If we're talking about, if the issues are crossed, we're talking about controlled substances and billing fraud at the same time, these guys are likely to come in together.
When you say fraud, then, I guess that reminded me, yes, besides just financial fraud, there's billing kickbacks and things like that.
Right. So fraud, waste and abuse in healthcare, that's paying kickbacks. Kickbacks could be paying to your marketer a commission, and your marketer is not your employee. It's a marketer 1099. You pay him $20 per patient he brings in, or you pay him 10% of your revenues. So that's kickback, one type of kickback. Another kickback is if you're paying something to the patient. That's not necessarily as a payment. It could be free service, waiving copay, or similar. That's another kickback. It's a criminal statute. So potentially we're talking about criminal investigation. At FBI.
One of my team members was complaining about how all these Medicare plans seem to be given copay discounts, but I didn't think they were supposed to do that. I thought that was kind of a kickback thing.
As long as this reduction or copay assistance does not involve Medicare or Medicaid patients, it does not fit within anti-kickback statute. So anti-kickback statute on the federal level applies only to any government-sponsored program, Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, and so on. So you are not supposed to apply any coupons or waiver reduction or anything like that for government-sponsored patients. Every state has anti-kickback state laws as well. In California, for example, it's more punitive. Anybody, third plans, cash patients, but on the federal level, it's only Medicaid, Medicare.
What actions in a pharmacy, whether DEA actions or FBI actions, what actions more than likely is a pharmacist going to end up in prison for? There's different attorneys and different judges and all that, but what's something that you can say? More than likely, a person who does this is probably going to go to prison for some time.
Any fraud, and fraud implicates intention. So if it's an oversight, if it's record keeping, they could try to label it as a criminal investigation, but chances are you have good defense. But if you do intend to violate the law, and if you do commit fraud, that's very likely to have some sort of, and if you're caught, of course, that's very likely to cause some sort of criminal implications.
Ignorance, though, of the law, especially when people have to get fraud, waste, and abuse training, is not an excuse, right?
Right. But very often, if you can show that this was an oversight, I mean, usually criminal cases, it's obvious to a layperson. I mean, something is going on. They will look at the case. And again, it's very, very difficult to define. But I'll give you an example. So in one of my cases, a pharmacy was undergoing a PBM audit. And PBM identified drug shortages. They did invoice reconciliation. They didn't have enough purchases. So to remedy this, the pharmacy owner conspired with a wholesaler, and they presented fake invoices. I mean, what do you think? Is it a criminal case, or is it the record-keeping issue or oversight? I think that's pretty straightforward. It's fraud. So the person is in jail right now, actually, in prison. And it's an older gentleman, and it's difficult. But he decided to do that. And he was caught. On the other hand, if, for example, you feel controlled substances, ignoring red flags. Some of the red flags, let's not say it was just like a pill mill, but you were doing your due diligence, but you're missing some red flags. There is a law that you have to exercise corresponding responsibility, but you don't, let's say. So that's already a gray area case. You have to prove that there was no really blatant ignorance of law. This is, you know, you did some steps, but you ignored some of them and you corrected, you know, your behavior going forward. So you have much better chances for the case just to end up with monetary penalties.
I imagine because you're fighting on the side of the pharmacist that you would have a lot of these examples, but do any cases come to mind where someone actually went to prison and you say to yourself, and maybe you think most of your peers would say, that doesn't make any sense?
No. If somebody goes to prison, usually in healthcare fraud context, that's usually there was really something going on.
Someone who is in prison is there because they intended to do fraud.
Yep.
And almost everybody would agree that person's guilty. Now, maybe the term of their punishment, someone could argue, but they're not there by chance. They're there because it's proven fraud and nearly everybody would agree upon it.
Yeah, because remember, to go to prison, you have to go through a trial. And if you have good healthcare fraud criminal attorney, if there are any defense, they'll bring it up, of course. Anything possible, witnesses, anything, you have your chance to argue your case. And if there is any doubt, I've never had anybody who didn't really commit the crime who actually went to prison.
Yeah.
So my cases that did end up in prison usually were pretty serious.
Obvious intent, pretty serious. There's not probably a chance of anybody sitting there as an innocent soul in prison from pharmacy.
Right. But on the other hand, I had cases which did not end up with prison or criminal sentence, but end up, for example, losing business. Unjustifiably. So when somebody didn't do anything really, especially with PBM audits or some sort of a monetary penalties imposed by government, they lose their business. And that was completely unjustified. It could have been oversight, could have been some mistake, might have been some delegation, unwise delegation of duty, something like that.
And in most of those cases, their business is gone because the financial punishment was so big or recoupment, it wasn't necessarily they just lost their license.
Yeah. So usually, yeah, what I'm thinking is PBM audits when they terminate pharmacies and ODA when they impose their hefty penalties, monetary penalties.
I've heard with PBM audits, and I'm thinking this is true the more I'm talking to you, that the PBMs will, I like to say it in a negative context, they like to snitch on their pharmacies and tell the government about you. So even if it's a small monetary recoupment, it behooves the pharmacist to put up a fight and to show the paper trail of that fight, which might slow down the PBM from giving this to the government if they know there's at least a decent argument behind it. Would that be good advice?
So, first of all, I don't think PBMs refer cases to government in every instance when they identify something shady, because the government is not going to be involved if it's not justified. They don't want to waste their time. So PBMs need to show some sort of pattern of wrongdoing. If it's just something really, really nominal or does not justify federal time, most likely they will not send the case. And they don't do it all the time. Only when they do think that this is a pretty serious case. But I do agree with you that every time you get a notice from PBM, you need to take it seriously. So audit results, and they identify some drug shortages, let's say they identify some patients the night that they received prescriptions, a prescriber the night that they wrote this prescription. And the pharmacist get this, you know, results and says, yeah, this is, they can charge back. That's fine. I don't care. It's just a few $1,000s. I'm not going to spend, you know, money on the attorney's fees or my time and disputing this. They can take it. But that's not a very wise approach because they flag your pharmacy. So, okay, some patients denied they received medication. That means you billed, but you did not deliver. That's fraud. Okay, some prescribers deny that they wrote scripts. That's fraud. Where do you dispense not based on valid prescription? That means, or drug shortages. Maybe you bought medication on black market. Or maybe you just didn't dispense anything. So you should, even if it's a nominal amount and it doesn't seem like it's a series of big deal, you should respond. And you should reach out to those patients who denied getting the medication, get their statements if possible, reach out to prescriber, get their statements, why they denied. And it happens all the time with prescribers because they just don't have time. The office, they're like, oh, we don't remember. The preliminary review doesn't show this prescription, and that's it. And it was somebody else who wrote it in the office or something like that. So dig in the case and present everything you can, because again, they will flag you. A potential, they can even terminate the contract. And nowadays, PBMs are so punitive. For example, Envision suspends pharmacies without even giving the opportunity to respond. So they do preliminary audit. They identify some issues and they suspend the pharmacy pending the audit. And I had a client who recently was suspended like that, and 60% of her business was on Envision. She can't function. That's it. She has to close. She has to sell her pharmacy and nobody will buy it now. And we're working with them. We want to expedite. We want to show that there's no fraud. It takes them not very long, not as long as Board of Pharmacy's investigations, of course. But still, they process information. You have to appeal. You have to do all different things. And it's at least 6 months suspension, usually. So it's very important to pay attention to how you respond to PBMs and respond to absolutely everything.
Because even if the results are the same, which hopefully they're not, if you've done your homework, you're going to bring up some important issues that maybe the financial hit's not as bad. But even if the results are the same, just that fight, just that paper trail and so on might prevent them from throwing a red flag on something or whatever.
They will probably still recoup, but at least they won't terminate the pharmacy because your reasons, they have something in it. They understand this probably was not fraud. This looks like an oversight. And if you send a corrective action plan saying, okay, maybe there was an oversight. This is our new policy acknowledged by all staff. Probably there will be nothing. Recoupment and that's it. And we continue.
Yeah, that's the difference between an oversight and fraud. The financial hit might be the same, but there's a difference on the back end of
right
of losing the contract or whatever.
Right.
So Natalia, someone comes to you, and when you're fighting something as an attorney against the other side, are you trying to block tricks from the other side, like legal tricks that they think they can pull on someone who doesn't have the experience? Let's say a pharmacy didn't have an attorney. Are they trying to pull tricks on them? Are you there mainly to make sure things fit into the legal structure? Or are you able to pull tricks on them?
Well, it's a tricky question. So it depends when I'm involved in the case, first of all. If they call me when, so are you too late? There's nothing usual I can do besides find them a good criminal defense attorney. If it's at the very initial stage, I mostly work with DEA in the West. So I usually know people and I know the approach to audits.
you know people actually, like their individual approach.
Right, right. Who goes on the field? Yeah, right, right, right. The special agent in charge or DIs, diversion investigators who come to the pharmacy. So I usually know what they're trying to get. So I have this DI, he's no longer here, diversion investigator, who always ask pharmacies to surrender on the spot. Always. He'll come no matter what he finds. He's like, it doesn't look very good. Better surrender right now. And that's the end of it. We won't receive any monetary penalties. And I don't really understand why they do that.
Surrender your pharmacy?
No, the registration, DEA registrations.
Which then would prevent them from doing controlled drugs?
Right. Controlled substances. Yeah. But that's pretty much the end of the pharmacy too.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure.
Yeah. So that was his trick. And if the pharmacist calls me and says, you know, this DI is here, I'm like, just, you know, just keep him happy. Just, you know, just don't do anything. Do not, of course, you know, surrender. Just, you know, tell him, you know, I'll think about this and just be nice to him. He likes, you know, nice pharmacists and just appear that you're trying to cooperate, but you'll need more time. So that will work with his DI, but maybe it won't work with another DI. So it again depends. The tricks, as you call them, could very, very depend on geographical location. I have a client, for example, in Hawaii, and we had the recent DA audit, and a DA agent was the most pleasant guy I've ever met. He was so nice. He identified some issues, and some issues were actually could be considered pretty serious in other states. And he just said, you know, I really think you need to change your policy, how you do this. And I'm here to help you. So, I mean, no tricks. He sees that the pharmacy is a legitimate pharmacy. It's not something he needs to worry about in his district. And he wants to make sure they comply.
Is that case over yet?
Yeah.
Because watch those nice guys.
No, it's over. It's over.
You got to look at the whole picture.
Yeah, we got a letter of admonishment, which is pretty much like a slap on your hand. Don't do this anymore. And that's it. The case is closed. Yes. But I do agree that some very nice guys could turn out to be very nasty at the end. I do agree. Yeah, yeah.
That investigator sounds like a real, pardon my French, but a real ass, that he will have people surrender their license. And if they don't think about it, like we talked earlier, if they're blabbing, they could surrender their license. If that's his MO across the board, he could have people surrendering their license for almost nothing.
You know, honestly, I don't understand why some of the DIs do that, because I mean, what's the incentive? I mean, when they come with monetary penalties, you understand. That's kind of on their record that they made so much money for the government. But if he's closing all the pharmacies, you know, his neighborhood, his district, I mean, how is that benefiting anybody? So I don't know where he's coming from, but I think maybe it's a concern that there's this record keeping issue, it can escalate something more, and he just doesn't want to deal with it. It's easier for him.
Hmm.
Maybe, I don't know. But again, not all DIs will ask you to surrender. Some of them really will go after monetary penalties. I had the case where a pharmacy was missing patient addresses on every script. There were no addresses. And they had thousands of scripts like this. And a monetary penalty for record keeping similar to that is $15,000 per violation. So multiply that $15,000 for 10,000 scripts, for example. We're talking about, what, $150 million or something? I don't know. I'm real bad with math.
That's a hell of a lot of money, yeah.
Yeah, so they were going after this pharmacy to say, well, we could take in all this that much, but we actually agree on $10 million, and that's a small pharmacy. So, of course, you know, and some of them are very aggressive in trying to collect. They will file a case in court to get monetary penalties. And remember, this is the penalty set by statute. So it's not like it's their discretion. But the statute says you miss for any record-keeping issues, this is your penalty. Okay. So if they go to court and they can prove every single violation, the judges will very likely say, well, that's the statute tells me to impose $15,000 on every single violation. And well, we settled this case for much, much, much less, of course, but DA is very aggressive in getting monetary penalties.
Are those agents, are they a lot of times trying to climb the ladder of the agency? And if they get so many feathers in their hat for closing pharmacies or raising so much money and penalties and so on, is that a good thing?
So I can't talk about DA because I don't know the internal policy. But if we talk about Department of Justice, this AUSA attorneys who work on the case, yes, more cases they prosecute better. They're usually, and again, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that bonuses depend on that as well. And their reputation. For example, every time there's a big settlement, there's announcement, press release. This case prosecuted by this division by attorney so-and-so. So if this attorney so-and-so is having all this large settlements, I mean, that's his reputational. They do want to collect as much as possible for the government and prosecute as many cases as possible.
If you needed to put your stats on the front page of the newspaper or the internet and so on, as sort of the defense attorney, let's say, what would be your feathers in your cap? Would you say how many pharmacies you kept open or how many DEA licenses you saved? As a business person, also, it's making a living wage. But what would you put as your markers of success?
Well, I usually don't put any feathers, as you call them, because sometimes I don't think it's very ethical, because every case is, legal perspective, it's every case is so different, so different.
You don't want to have a certain goal of each one because all the goals are different.
It looks like I'm promising something. And very often, you know, people come and say, well, she did, she on her website, she said she could dismiss this and she didn't dismiss this case for me. And it's like representing that you, like it's giving this, you know, sense of hope. But, you know, if, for example, if I'm talking about any achievement, so I just closed the case, for example, DA case two, the client was hit with $3 million penalty. And she was represented by another attorney, also a healthcare attorney, but not specializing with pharmacy. So the case revolved around CSOS confirmation. So what DI did when he came to the pharmacy, he went to the pharmacist's email and he downloaded and printed CSOS confirmation from the wholesaler, every single one of them. And if you know, the email confirmation does not state the quantity and date received. So they went after the pharmacy saying that he never recorded quantity and date received. He never logged it in his CSOS.
For our listeners, this is when you get this special order in that you have ordered your very strict controlled drugs on.
C2s.
You then have to say, yes, I received this on this date and sign it and date it and so on and then save these. This guy didn't have those. So he went in, though, and just downloaded them in the email.
Right. So they claim that the pharmacist did not record quantity received, date received when they got received the C2s from the wholesaler. So the healthcare attorney working on this case, he recommended to settle, and the government went as down as 1.8, I think, and they wouldn't go down anymore. So the pharmacist decided to call me, and I looked and said, like, wait a minute, this is just your email confirmation from the wholesaler. They cannot go after you for not required quantity and date based on the email confirmation. So we actually went to CSOS system, and every single entry was there, and the case was closed. So, yeah, we were able to show, and DA really didn't want to believe us. They subpoenaed the records from the wholesaler, CSOS audit records. So usually it's not a paper trail. When there's a shipment of C2s, the pharmacy goes to the CSOS portal, and they're like, okay, on this date, we did receive this quantity. That's it. And the pharmacy was doing that. They just, the DI, for some reason, didn't look at CSOS portal. They looked at email confirmations.
So they wanted a couple million dollars because they just didn't have the physical paper printed off when they had done all this on the Seesaw's program.
They just didn't understand how Seesaw's system works. So because the pharmacy does not, the wholesaler will send the Seesaw's confirmation when the product is not received yet. So the pharmacy cannot input received and date on an email copy, but they will go in physically into Seesaw's portal and input in this information.
I know everybody's got to follow the rules, but that's an example there of like fraud versus...
But this is not even oversight. This is just the DA's inability to understand how the system works.
That wasn't oversight. That was incompetence by the DEA.
They were doing everything right. But the problem here was that the pharmacy was so scared that they're like, yeah, we did something wrong. We're going to pay $3 million. And they were ready to pay that $1 million.
Yeah.
With the other attorney. The other attorney said, you know, I met with AU today and the case doesn't look good. But good news, they're going down to $1.8 million. Let's accept it. So he decided to get second opinion and he involved me because I specialize in pharmacy, not in healthcare. And this is so unique to pharmacy.
Right.
Again.
Right.
Physicians are not going to then be dealing with Seesaw's.
Yeah, that's a great example of living this. And it's simple. I mean, it's simple for you, but it's only simple because you've dedicated your career to pharmacy.
Right. Yeah.
Natalia, we talked about getting a hold of you if they see the blue coats walk in. If you could, like, go into a pharmacy and, well, just talking to the listeners, what should we be doing that on average we might not be doing well enough?
There are so many things. And it depends again on the pharmacy. For example, I went to one of my clients, I think last year, and I come to the counter and she has a pad, where every single patient signs, puts the date, the name, the drug, and sign. But you can see other patients' information as well. So, I mean, this is such an obvious HIPAA violation. So some pharmacies might not pay enough attention to HIPAA privacy. Some of them might not perform record keeping properly. It depends. Every pharmacy is so different. There are some specialty pharmacies. They have completely different issues. The compounding pharmacies, completely different issues. So, but on average, if you can prioritize record keeping, that could save a lot of headache. Mm. DEA, for example, makes it easy. If you go to the website, DEA diversion, I think that .gov or something like that. But if you put DEA diversion, the very first site is that site. And they have tons of resources there. They have the whole code of federal regulations pertaining to controlled substances there. They have the Controlled Substances Act. Mm. And they make it easy. They go, okay, this section deals with record keeping. This is all you need to do. This goes to background screening checks. This is all you have to do. So, and many pharmacies do not do that. I mean, they do have policies and procedures. They do have manuals. But they don't follow them. They don't read them. They buy it somewhere and that's it. That's the end of it. And DA also has database on their website of all the cases. Of all the, not the investigations, but the cases which ended up with administrative hearing. So where pharmacies were arguing. So there are lots of resources. And I think compliance is easy nowadays. I mean, it's not as easy as we want it to be. But it's very doable. And if you want to stay in this business, compliance record keeping is your foundation upon which you can build your business. So it's very, very important. When we had this COVID quarantine started, we launched a website called RX Policy where we sell compliance documents. So because I saw this need, you know, they don't customize their policies or procedures. They don't pay attention to it. Sometimes they just tell me it's difficult and it's expensive to find something online. So we started this website. We had some great feedback, but it's just a drop in the ocean, which you can do. It's just getting policy and procedures is not enough. You have to be on top of it. And it really pays off if you have certain people dedicated to make sure you look compliant or you are doing proper record keeping. You're separating your C2, C3, C5s in different files, things like that. It pays off.
Different people know they should do certain things. They maybe just don't do them, like exercise, lose weight, this, that. There's a ton of things that people say, I should be doing that. And I think across the board, there's probably pharmacies that are just more lax on certain things with no real justifiable reason. They just maybe have never gotten around to something. They figure that it's not that big of a deal because they don't know anybody that's been in trouble for it ever, and just doesn't seem like that big of a deal. But that doesn't necessarily correlate with how the DEA sees that.
Right, right. And I think the problem is very often pharmacists are very busy with running the business, dispensing. They're busy with their work. And with all this low reimbursement rates and all these cuts, they very often cannot dedicate a certain person for compliance or for making sure policies and procedures are updated every year. Or they do all this training, which is recommended. It's difficult. It's a very difficult profession. I really admire them, but they're still dispensing and there's still retail pharmacies out there. I think that's just they're real heroes out there, because the reimbursement rates nowadays, you probably know it better than I do, are not as they used to be.
Right.
Like some pharmacies are just making a very, very small profit margin, or they're not making any money. Some are even losing money. And when you're in this business climate, compliance is not on your top priority list.
Your business. So with your RX policy, you can hit people across the country. As an attorney, are you pretty much in your area, or can you do attorney work across the country somehow?
So I'm licensed in California. That means that any state matters, only limited to California. Any federal matters, I can do them. So federal matters, we're talking about DEA, FDA, OIG compliance, PBM audits, Medicare billing, Medicaid disputes, DME, licensure. So anything on the federal arena, I can help. If it goes into state-specific issues, I usually refer people to my vast network of other pharmacy attorneys. I'm a member of my membership committee, actually, for American Society for Pharmacy Law. And I should throw a little pitch out there for the group. It's a great organization to stay top, abreast of all legal developments. And attorneys from all over the country come to, we have annual conferences. One is coming up in November. Great group. Great networking.
Say the name of the group again.
American Society for Pharmacy Law. It's not only attorneys. We have quite a few pharmacists. All chains represented because they have regulatory compliance people just dedicated to compliance. We have some retail pharmacies. We have annual conferences. We have tons of materials. We have a referral list. For example, you're in Michigan. You're looking for a pharmacy attorney specialized in Michigan law, board of pharmacy representation. You'll be able to find one there. And great networking, all PBM attorneys there too. So before I joined this group, I remember I would call PBMs, I will email the legal team, I wouldn't hear anything. Now that I know some of them through this group, it takes me a few hours to get a hold of them and explain what's going on so they can look into this. It doesn't mean that I'm getting what I want from them, but I get attention because of this person connection through the group.
The dark side has attorneys in this group also.
Yes, because it's a pharmacy law. So we have wholesalers.
Gotcha.
We have Inuit chain stores, I think all represented. For example, we have conference coming up in November. We'll be talking about all kind of regulatory updates, what's going on the legal arena, DA updates every year, and we share what we see in our cases. It's a great group.
Interesting.
So And if you were, for example, a first-time member, you usually sign to a mentor. And I've done it many times when people are just coming to the group and I'm volunteering to be the mentor and I introduce them to, for example, it's a pharmacy student and they want to, they're more interested in pharmacy compliance, regulatory compliance, and I introduce them to people in the area if I know them, for example. So it's a very, very good networking group.
So we talk about the DEA guys and gals, let's say they like to go up the ladder, you know, and get these bigger wins. Are they just picking on the independents because they're easier to pick on, or will they go into chains and do this stuff too?
So usually they target independent pharmacies because if you think about it, chains, they have usually a robust compliance department, and it's not like one owner who is financially interested in some fraudulent activity. These are pharmacists, they pay per hour. They have no financial incentive to defraud or commit any violations or engage in any pill mill activity. And plus, every single chain, they have a very large legal department.
Right.
Which is staying on top of compliance. And DA or any other investigators on board of pharmacy, they know that. They know that they are doing their fraud and abuse training every year,
right.
HIPAA training every year, versus independent pharmacies. What's the oversight? Could be one owner, one pick business. And who is overseeing who? There's more room to commit any kind of fraudulent activity. Yeah.
A pharmacist is listening to this and they say, not fraudulent. Maybe I could do a little bit better on my record keeping. What should a pharmacist do? Let's say they got 10 minutes that they want to do something in their pharmacy after listening to this. What are some steps they should be looking at, double checking, etc.?
Probably, I would say updating your policies and procedures because people really don't pay attention to them. But this is one of the first documents Board of Pharmacy reviews when they come in. And many pharmacists, they don't update them. And they have outdated policies out there. Nobody reads them. So go through your policy and procedures. Make sure it complies with DEA regulation. And I already explained how to access them. And your local Board of Pharmacy regulations. And they're there, and everybody in the pharmacy trained on that. That's number one step to prevent any troubles going forward.
Just pulling one out and saying, I've got one from 12 years ago, one of the main things is dusting it off, making sure it complies with what's happening in the real world with your state and with the feds, and probably hoping some of that's actually being done in your pharmacy too. It's kind of a combo kit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually better not to have policy and procedure than have a policy and not to follow it. Because then the board cites you for not following your own internal policy.
Oh, that's interesting. So yes, so we got to make sure that anybody who's got policies just because their state board said they should have one or something,
mm-hmm.
You're saying it's worse to have one and not follow it than just to not even having one.
Right. Yeah. There are only a handful of policies that are required by state laws. In California, I think we have just like, I think 5 or 6, which are actually required by law to have. Like technician description, job description, for example, or what happens if there's an impaired employee. So only a few. But usually the manual contains much more. And if you have all this optional policies and procedures which do not apply to you, it's like, why? You're not following your internal policy and you cite it very often. So that's number one, I think, step to kind of bring, you know, come to up to date with compliance, I think. And stay informed. Of course, you know, Board of Pharmacy alerts, or anything, government alerts, or what's going on in the industry. Because as we talked about, many pharmacists are very busy in the field that they just don't know what's happening. I have a lot of clients who are much older and they're still doing business as they used to do it 20 years ago, but that's not working anymore. With this aggressive regulatory environment with PBMs, I mean, they're lucky that they still didn't get in trouble. But it could be one day when they really have to, they may lose their investment, their lifetime investment, just because they're just not paying attention to what's going on in the field.
What's your blog? Which is interesting. You put some cool stuff out on there.
Yes, it's farmhealthlaw.com.
Farmhealthlaw.com.
Yes. Yeah. So I try to cover some of the practical points that I come across. So for example, I come across some settlements and I'm like, oh, this is relevant. I deal with it all the time. Or some practice points for my practice. For example, I just recently this year learned that when you do, when they're, you know, aberrant quantities list and with Caremark. So I had no idea that they take into consideration reversals when they compute an aberrant quantity. So I'm like, okay, everybody should know that. So make sure your reversals and I'm going over 25% of this aberrant quantity list. So I wrote a blog about that. Things like that. This is pretty practical. I have good feedback about it. We don't have that much engagement. I've noticed with pharmacists, they've shy to say something about, oh, this is what's happening with me, or they're quiet much.
Sure.
Yeah. But I do put information out there.
Yeah. Well, Natalia, you'll be my first phone call from prison.
No, never happened to you.
We're not going to prison.
No, we're not going to prison.
But pleasure talking to you, Natalia, and thanks for all you're doing for the profession.
Well, thank you for putting this together because I think it's useful as well. More information they have, pharmacists have, more equipped they are to understand what's going on and properly address issues.
Yeah, and I think the real life stuff's important because there's a ton of rules out there and all of them are important, but hearing the ones that rise up to the top, that's important. It's good that everybody is adding in thoughts and stuff. It's good.
Yes, yes, I'm glad. We need more information out there. And I really applaud when I see pharmacists forming their own associations, independent associations where they just share experience. Somebody's having this crazy DI guy writes to everybody in the group, you know, be on the lookout. This is what they're doing to everybody nowadays. But, you know, again, we're in a very competitive industry as well. So, but I do applaud pharmacists who are willing to share the experience and educate others because I saw people who are actually trying to be very competitive and actually not sharing information and actually damage each other. And I've had tons of cases where pharmacists are calling on each other and saying, you know, this pharmacist is doing something shady. You should investigate. Yeah. So it's an interesting profession, interesting dynamic.
Independence, by nature of the name being independent, you got people that are independent helping each other. You also have people that are independent competitors of each other and maybe go in the opposite direction a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Natalia. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Mike.
Talk again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer.